Hello, my name is William. I am 18 years old, and today is March 22nd. And I'm speaking with John Kretzer, who is my father, and we're recording this over FaceTime because he's up in Puyallup, Washington, and I'm down here in Denton, Texas. All right, so where were you when the Berlin Wall fell?
Actually, when the Berlin Wall came down, I was in Germany, and so I got to experience it firsthand.
And how come you were in Germany at the time?
Well, the reason I was in Germany at the time is I was in the military. I was in the Army specifically, and Germany was my duty station at that particular time.
So, how come you were in the Army? What influenced you to join the Army?
There were really kind of a lot of factors that led up to my decision to join the military. In a nutshell, however, I had finished high school. I had the opportunity to either attend Texas A&M and study electronic engineering or the Citadel, and I could have done both on a scholarship. But at that point, I was young, fresh high school graduate, 18 years old, and I actually wanted to get out and see a little bit of the world first. And so I decided to go ahead and join the military so that I could travel a little bit and get some life's experiences other than what I'd grown up with, and forego college for a few years.
So what do you mean with what you grew up with?
Well, I grew up somewhat limited. I mean, we were very poor. My father passed away when I was 7 years old. My mother had a sixth grade education. And so we grew up very poor, and we never, as far as I can recall, I'd never been anywhere outside of San Antonio my entire life.
Oh, so you're in San Antonio.
Yes.
And you left when you were 18?
Yes.
Do you know what caused your father's early death?
It was not actually an early death. There was a big age gap between my mother and my father. My father was 62 years old when I was born. And my mother was 38 at that time. And he died of a heart attack.
Oh, wow.
I remember that night fairly clearly. We were, I'd already gone to bed, but there was some commotion out in the kitchen. And I went into the kitchen, and my father was sitting at the kitchen table. He was upset. There's a bunch of noise outside, and he'd already had a heart attack previously, and he used to take medicine for that. And he was sitting there at the kitchen table with his head down on the table, and my mother asked him, said, "Do you want your nitroglycerin?" And he waved her off, and then all of a sudden he just sat bolt upright in the chair, tipped over backwards, and that was it. By the time the ambulance got there, he was dead.
Wow. Was that a traumatizing experience for you?
That's, not to sound like calloused or anything, but it kind of wasn't, because I was only seven, and so it didn't really click. Or it didn't really register that he had died right there in front of me. I remember when the paramedics got there, they hooked him up to the heart monitor, and I just remember seeing the flat line and going, "Oh, he doesn't have a heartbeat, he's dead." And just sort of matter-of-factly, you know, and I remember my mom telling me, "Oh, don't say that, you know, you can't say that because he's going to be okay." And I was like, "No." And I was arguing with her about it. I was like, "No, look, the line is flat. He's dead," and which turned out to be right. But did it affect me? Sure. I mean, you know, he was my dad. But it didn't. It wasn't like this big, huge, traumatic experience, which I guess some people would think it should be, especially since I witnessed it firsthand. But it was just, I don't know. It's kind of hard to describe.
If your dad had not died when you were seven, how different do you think your life would have been?
Oh, that's a really good hypothetical question. It's really hard to say because I had a really good relationship with my dad, and who knows, I might never have joined the army. I might have followed him in his profession, which he was a butcher, and who knows, I might have ended up staying in San Antonio my whole life and becoming a butcher. Then again, it's hard to say because as children grow, you know, you develop your own minds and you develop your own wants and desires, and you tend to end up following your own dreams. And I might have ended up taking the exact same path. And so that's kind of a tough question to answer. I would think it probably ended up the same, but I could be totally wrong.
Did you have any other father figures after your dad passed?
Actually, I did. A couple of years after my father passed, I met my best friend, Richard Heitzman, and we grew up together since sixth grade, and his parents were very familiar with my situation, which was my mother worked a lot to earn enough money working minimum wage jobs. You know, she had to work a lot just to make enough money to get by. And so I was kind of on my own a lot, and I spent a lot of time with Rich, and his family kind of took me in and made me one of their own. And so when I mentioned earlier that I didn't really get to go anywhere growing up, that's not quite true, because whenever they took a vacation somewhere, which was typically inside of Texas, they kind of took me along with them. It was like a lot of camping and fishing vacations, little things like that. We'd go down to the lake or something like that. Although one year they did go visit relatives up in Indiana, and they actually took me along with them.
Wow, that was, I thought I was pretty kind. So, why the Army?
Well, I looked at all of the branches once I had made the decision that I was not going to go straight into college out of high school. I looked at the different branches. The Marine Corps couldn't really offer anything. As you know, you take an ASVAB, the Armed Services Vocational Test, that see where your aptitudes lie, and that's what they, based on your scores, they'll offer you a profession or a job in the military. The Marine Corps didn't really have a whole lot to offer that interests me, because the Marine Corps is very small, very specialized. The Navy offered me their nuclear power school, which was a two-year school in Florida. And the Army said, you really, with your scores, you can kind of take whatever job you want. And one of the things I was really looking for was I wanted to go visit Germany. That was one of the things I wanted as far as going out and seeing the world, is I really wanted to visit Germany. And I asked the Navy recruiter, I said, hey, well, what about going to Germany? He said, well, your ship might stop in Germany at one of the ports. And the Army recruiter said, if you want, I can put in your contract that Germany will be your first duty station as a guarantee. And when he said that, I said, well, where do I sign? And so that's why I ended up being in the Army.
Why did you want to go to Germany so badly?
It's actually part of our heritage. My father, like I said, he although he passed while I was young, I do know enough of him and through later research on my own that our family comes from Germany. I used to hear him speak German to the neighbors all the time when I was a child. He didn't speak a whole lot to me, you know, a few phrases here and there, but he spoke it as a native language for him. Going back historically, my great-great-grandfather, your great-great-great-grandfather, was one of the original German settlers to Texas. Most people don't realize that Texas has a huge German history and a fairly large German population. Starting in the 1840s, before a revolution, a failed revolution in Germany, a lot of, over a million Germans fled. And a lot of them ended up in Texas. They came in through the port of Galveston, and they started populating little towns or creating little towns, villages, settlements, all the way through westward of San Antonio. And that area of Texas became known as the German Belt of Texas. And a lot of the towns, because they were strictly German settlements, they never learned English, and they maintained their own, they maintained their language, they maintained their own heritage, they maintained their own culture, their own traditions. for follow on multiple generations. And my father belonged to that, and so that was why he still spoke German, even though that was a good 60, 70 years after German settlement, and he was born in Texas. So he still spoke German, so I knew it was a big part of our family history. And I found this out once I started taking German. Well, I already knew that, but then, of course, I took German in high school because you have to take a language in high school. I took German because I wanted to learn it. Because I didn't do that growing up. And I developed such an interest in not just the culture for itself, but because it was part of family history. And so for that reason, I wanted to go to Germany. And with the Army guaranteeing it, that's why I joined the Army. And indeed, after I finished basic training and AIT, which is where you learn your specialty, I went to Germany as my very first duty station.
So your dad did not teach you any German?
Not as I did a little bit with you and as I've been doing with your sisters now. It was a different culture back then. It was viewed as you live in America, you learn to speak English, and you're culture sort of got, your native culture sort of got pushed aside. Not to mention, at that time, you know, it was 30 years post-World War II, but there was still a lot of stigma. I remember some kids in my class calling me a Nazi when I was a kid. Because I was of German heritage.
Wow. Did your dad speak any sort of dialect, or...
As far as I can remember, he spoke the Texas German dialect, which is pretty much a dead dialect now. The reason for that is, as the settlers started integrating more into Texas life and interacting more with outsiders, they started to develop a dialect that was their own regional dialect that was very specific to Texas. And they just incorporated or they Germanicized certain English words. For example, the word for to move, like from one house to another, in German is umziehen. That's the standard German word. And in the Texas German dialect, it would be moven. They simply took the word move and made it moven, and they incorporated it in all its normal grammatical features. So you wouldn't say ich bin umgezogen, you would say in Texas German they would say ich bin gemoved.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah.
So do you know when the wall was erected in Berlin?
Yeah, going back to that, I was very fortunate when I got to Germany. I'll come back to that. I didn't have to live in the barracks. I actually got to live off post, so I really got to see a lot of Germany, experience a lot of the culture. But to answer your question, the wall was first erected literally overnight in 1961. But the erection of the wall overnight was not a wall. It was simply... they put up barbed wire fence overnight in the city of Berlin to divide the eastern from the western sectors. And that was in August. I don't remember the exact date, but I know it was 1961.
Were you in Germany at the time?
Or I wasn't even born at that time.
I'm so sorry. Yeah, that's right. You were... whoopsie. Gotcha. Wow. How long was it up before it fell?
See, it went up in 61, it came down in 89, so that was almost 40 years. Not quite 40 years. And when it came down, when people talk about the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, it didn't actually fall. What they did was they opened the border crossings to allow people to come and go as they want. It didn't actually get completely taken down and removed till a couple of years later. Because it was a huge project. When it first went up, it divided only the city of Berlin from the between the two sectors, eastern and western, and it was just barbed wire overnight. Then over the next 30 years, they built it and extended it not just to divide the city of Berlin, but to actually divide eastern and western Germany. After World War II, Germany was divided into two basic sectors, and that was the western sector, which was divided amongst the three Allied powers, France, the United States, and Great Britain. And then there was the eastern sector that belonged to the Soviet Union. And they got several states to include the state of Brandenburg, Sachsen-Anhalt, Sachsen. And they divided the country by a wall, by a huge wall that just got bigger and bigger with time to prevent. Well, it depends on who you ask. If you ask the Soviet side, the wall was erected to protect its citizens from fascist influence as they tried to build up a socialist system, a socialist economy. If you ask the Western side, the Allied side, the wall was put up to prevent East Germans from fleeing to West Germany.
How did the world react to the wall going up just overnight?
They were all sort of fairly shocked, I think, that would happen. And as it grew and grew, of course, it just became part of the political landscape where it was known, but it wasn't so well known that it became a political hot potato or anything like that. And I think most Westerners were so isolated from it that it was irrelevant to them on a personal level.
So where in Germany were you stationed?
I was stationed in the northern Bavarian city of Würzburg, which was probably about 40 or 50 miles from the border. The closest border crossing I could get to was the state of Thuringen, which was, like I said, about 40 or 50 miles from where I was at. I only got to see the wall itself one time, and not the Berlin Wall, but rather the wall that divided eastern and western sectors. That was when I first got to Germany. It was mandatory for all military members to go up and see the border wall. The only people that were allowed within a kilometer of it, except for the special tour, were those that were in the 6th Cavalry Regiment that patrolled the western side of the border. Because the Cold War was on at that time, we kept border forces up there as an early warning system should they decide to invade western Germany at some point. The Cav was there as the initial line of defense. And so, Würzburg was about 40 or 50 miles back from the border, and other than the one time I never actually got to see it. I do remember quite well seeing it because it was a pretty imposing construction. It was probably about 40 or 50 feet high. There were guard towers placed close enough together where they could see each other and they could monitor all activity on the border. And I do remember when we got off the bus to view the wall and it was pointed out to us, the different border guards, what was on the other side and so on. You could see the border guards were up there with one with binoculars, another with a high-powered camera. They were taking pictures of all of us and they could keep track of how many American forces were in the country and who they were. And so I'm sure they ran our pictures through databases somewhere that said these are the soldiers that are there.
I'm assuming that's why they wouldn't allow you within a kilometer of the wall.
Yes, that was a big part of it. They just didn't want us near there so that our activities couldn't be tracked or monitored by border guards. The only activity they wanted was minimal activity, which was the cavalry regiment that monitored activity on the border.
What would have been, I guess, the protocol if there was an invasion?
I don't know if they've been declassified or not, but there were several protocols that we had. So I can't talk about details, but we had areas that we were responsible for defending. We had fallback areas. We had secondary areas and things like that, that each unit was responsible for a specific area and specific regimens of defense to defend West Germany and our allies as well as ourselves from a Soviet offensive.
Got you. So what were your normal day-to-day duties?
Well, with the Army, you have a variety of duties that you do. You have a specialty that you are trained for, and I did do that on a regular daily basis. Mine was electronics repair of an air defense system. And so parts would come in that needed to be repaired, and I'd work on those. But in addition to that, we had our daily duties of, you know, guard duty around our perimeter. We had our normal PT that we had to do on a daily basis, cleaning, things like that, just to make our operation run on a regular basis. That notwithstanding, we did have free time where we were able to travel freely as we wanted to, and we could actually take leave or vacation time while we were in Germany. We could travel back to the States if we wanted to. We could travel around Europe if we wanted to. Whatever we felt like doing, essentially.
Did you do anything like that?
Yeah, actually I did. I was one of the few in my unit who, every time I took vacation, I never went back to the States. Most of them that I knew, they would travel back to the United States for 2 or 3 weeks, you know, stay with family and do whatever else, and then they would come back. Whenever I took vacation in Europe, I traveled Europe. I traveled to as many countries as I could and saw as much as I could. I knew that I wouldn't have that kind of opportunity again. Like I'd mentioned previously, I grew up just dirt poor and never really got to go anywhere or see anything. And I knew that to travel Europe would be prohibitively expensive. But while you're stationed there, you have a base that you're staying at. I had my own apartment. And from there, I could hop on the train and travel where I wanted, when I wanted, stay in youth hostels and travel for super cheap. And the whole time, you know, I was getting, you know, paid for being there. So I had a paycheck, I had very few bills, and I was able to travel cheaply. And I got to travel. I went as far north as I could, which was Norway. Also into Sweden and Denmark. I traveled all around Germany, down into Italy, Austria, Switzerland, Liechtenstein, all the German-speaking countries. And so, yeah, I got to see and do a lot of things I would not normally have been able to do had I not been stationed there in the military.
So I believe earlier you said you took German in high school, right?
Yes.
Do you think that really prepared you for being in Germany or no?
Hugely, yes. I think it was. It gave me, although I was not an effective communicator when I first got there, at least not to the level now, I had the background to understand how the language functioned and how to say things, say basic things so that I could get by. And the more time I spent exposed to it, of course, the quicker I learned it. And because I had the fundamentals of the language, the rudiments of, you know, sentence structure and how to conjugate verbs and all those grammatical elements that are necessary, I was able to learn it fairly quickly.
What all things did you do to learn to become fluent in German?
Well, that's actually kind of funny because it takes me back to the previous statement I made. Is when I got to Germany, I was 19 years old, I was single, and normally in that situation, you live in the military barracks. But the barracks were full, and so I had to get an apartment off post. But eat that because it paused on me.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah, so I was 19, I was single, and they didn't have any room in the barracks, so rather than live in the barracks, I had to get an apartment off post. And so my thought was, I'm going to immerse myself in German as much as possible. Now, of course, I worked during the day at the base, and I had to speak English there. But as soon as I was done, I would ride the bus back to my apartment, and I wouldn't turn on Armed Forces Network and watch an American show or whatever else. I would turn on German TV, and I would sit there with a dictionary in my lap, and I would pick out as much as I could. Whenever there was a new word I didn't hear, I'd flip to the dictionary. And so in the beginning, I would miss a lot of what was being said, but I was picking up new words as it went on. Anytime I was not at work, I was or at home in the evening, like on the weekend, I would not go to the base. I would go somewhere there in the city, or if I had the whole weekend off, maybe I would catch a train and go to another town. And so I was out in German society as much as possible. And going back to an apartment, when you get an apartment, of course, you have to have utilities. So when I went downtown to get my water turned on, my electricity, and get telephone and things like that, of course, all of the clerks wanted to speak to me in English, knowing I was an American, but I insisted that they speak to me in German, and I tried to interact with them as much in German as possible. And so just all those little things forced me to use the language and use it in a way that I was able to get my – that required me to get my point across. And the more I did it, the better I got at it, until it got to the point where as I spoke German, I didn't so much think in English and translate as I thought about what I needed to say in German. So it became sort of second nature to me.
Tell me about your apartment in Germany.
Well, there were several. The very first apartment I lived in, the first two apartments I lived in was in the same building. It was probably about 2 miles from downtown, and it was occupied by all German college students, and then me. My very first apartment in that building was an attic apartment, and there was barely enough room to turn around. It had a bed in it, and it was in the attic. It was the attic apartment. So my wall on the right side of my bed was actually slanted because it was the roof. On the other side of my bed, I had about 5 feet till I hit another wall. Then the foot of the bed to the door was probably about another 10 feet, if that. And then it was a shared bathroom down the hall, so I had to actually get out of my apartment and go down the hall and that. When an actual full apartment opened up in that building, the landlord offered that to me, and I took that, and it was much bigger. I had actually a little kitchenette in it, had my own bathroom. It was what's considered to be an efficiency apartment. So I had the one big room, a little kitchen nook off to the side. It didn't have an actual oven, but it did have a two-burner stovetop, and then I had my own bathroom with shower. After that, I moved into an apartment out in the town of Rotenbauer, I believe is the name of the town. And that was just also a very small efficiency until a buddy of mine that I worked with was getting ready to leave to go back to the United States. The apartment that he and his wife had been living in was in a much smaller town called Guntersleben. And I had become familiar with the landlord from just hanging out at his place. And when they were getting ready to move out, the landlord, Horst Koenig, was like, offered me the apartment to take over. And so I took up that, and that was the last apartment that I lived in Germany. And that was actually really nice. It was a small basement apartment. It had its own, it was an efficiency. It had a living room, a bedroom, and a kitchen. And it was in the basement of the home that the family lived in. The family occupied the upstairs two floors, and I occupied the basement. And it was a real nice, like I said, basement apartment. It wasn't like in a dark, dank basement. It had a rear door that opened out onto a patio, and from there was a backyard that went downhill to other houses and things like that. And they were really nice to me, and they kind of took me in. I ended up spending a lot of time with them and actually becoming sort of a part of the town for a while.
So you were part of the town. Was there anything, I guess, interesting about the town, or?
Yeah, it was a wine-growing town, but it was also a pig-farming town. And when you are part of the town, you take part in all the daily activities that go on, and you're incorporated into actual German life more than you would be if you were not. And so whenever there was a festival that went on, pretty much everybody pitched in to help. And they had two big festivals every year in the town. One was a wine fest, and the other was a pig fest, because there were wine growers in that town, and there were also pig farmers in the town. And so with the wine fest, there wasn't a whole lot that I would do with that, because, you know, the vintners had their own things that they do to prepare, you know, pick the grapes, grow the grapes, pick the grapes, make the wine, things like that. But when it came to the pig fest, then, of course, I got to do things like help with the slaughter, make sausage, with the cooking and things like that. And so it was just like being a German in that town, even though I was an American soldier. The family, like I said, that was because the family kind of really took me in and introduced me to a lot of people. And I think it was kind of a novelty that I was an American who didn't just speak German. I actually spoke the dialect, because that was what I had learned. And so, like I said, they took me in, and they had, I was probably about 20, 21 at that time, and they had a son who was right about my age, and they had a younger daughter who's probably about 16 or 17, and she was in gymnasium preparing for college. And of course, in gymnasium, you have to study English. And so a couple times a week, they would come down, knock on my door, and say, "Hey, do you think you could, you want to come up and have dinner?" Which was kind of code for saying, "Hey, Chrissy needs help with her homework." And so I'd go upstairs and, you know, I'd have dinner with them, and then I'd help Chrissy with her homework, which her English was fantastic. And so I just became more and more part of the community through that.
Well, so would you say you were, I guess, part of Horst Koenig's family, or just really good friends?
Oof. That's tough. I'd almost say that I think it was somewhere in between, because I started going to church with them on Sunday, which in the very traditional Bavarian German sense is after church, two things would happen. The women would go home, and in today's view, it's very sexist, but it's just part of life. Or part of the lifestyle. The women would go home, they'd prepare dinner. The men would go down to the local pub, and they'd have a wine or beer, and they'd play cards or something like that. It was called Frühschoppen. It's the local word for it. That's how I started meeting other people, because I'd go to church with them on Sunday, and after Sunday church, I'd go down to the pub, and, you know, we'd have for Frühschoppen. And I'd hang out with them, and so I started meeting other people outside of the family. And then after that, we'd go home. We'd all have the, you know, family dinner together. And then, you know, start getting, breaking down for the next day. And Sundays also was typically when their father would come over. And he was an interesting fellow. He was, he had actually been a soldier during World War II. An unwilling soldier, as was often the case back then. And he was blind, and he had gone blind, you know, with age, because he was probably about 90. But he was still mentally very sharp, very facile. Chrissy would help him do crossword puzzles. She would read the clue to him, and she would tell him how many letters the word was, and he would search his mind and tell her, "Write this down." And that's how he would do crossword puzzles. But occasionally he would talk about, you know, how things were when he was growing up. And I do remember one of the stories was the way he became a German soldier as World War II was starting was the Nazi party came to his house. They got everybody out of the house. And they said, "Are you going to join the Nazi party?" And he said, "No." And they pulled out a pistol, and they held it to his mother's head, and they asked him the question again. I said, "Are you going to join the German military, to which, of course, at that point, he said yes. And so they took him away, and he was conscripted against his will, and he was forced to go to go fight.
Wow. So, did he actually do any killing, or did he try to avoid that as best as he could?
That was another one of the stories I remember, was he tried to avoid it as best as he could. He never, as far as he told me, he never actually shot anybody. When he was required to shoot, he would shoot in the air, where he knew the bullets would be going above the other soldiers' heads. And as soon as he got the opportunity to get captured, he allowed himself to be captured and went to a prisoner of war camp, where he spent the remainder of World War II until the war was over, and then he was released and was allowed to go back home.
Do you think a lot of soldiers did that?
According to him, there were quite a few, especially those comrades of his that were of the same mindset. They didn't want to fight. They thought what the Nazi Party was doing was unjust, and they didn't really want to have anything to do with it. And so they did their best to not actively support it, while at the same time making it look like they did support it so that their families would be safe.
What do you think would have happened if they got caught purposely not shooting people?
Oh, they would have probably been killed on the spot.
Good thing you didn't get caught then.
Yeah.
So, did you know that you would be in Germany when the wall fell?
I had no clue. It was more good fortune than anything else. When I joined the military, I was only going to do 4 years and then get out and then go to college. Like I'd mentioned previously, my intent was I just wanted to get out and see a little bit of the world before going back to college. But as things turned out, like I mentioned, I got to Germany. I was 19. I was single. They didn't have any room in the barracks, so I got an apartment. And so I got to become very immersed in the culture, and I got to travel and see and do a lot. And when my first term was finished with the military, they asked if I was going to re-enlist. And I said, no, I'm not going to re-enlist. And then I thought about it, and I was like, you know what? I told them I would re-enlist if I could get guaranteed to stay where I was at. Because I didn't really have any big plans other than to go back to the States and then reapply to college and so on. And so I was really kind of just drifting in the wind at that point. And they said, yeah, sure, we'll put it in contract that you'll stay here. And so I signed another contract, and another 2 years went by, and then did the same thing. And next thing you know, I'd been there for 7 years, which meant I'd already been in the military for over 8 years. But in any case, during that time, that was when Gorbachev came into power in the Soviet Union, and he was much more of a moderate than his predecessor. And so things were changing in the Soviet Union, and they started having big protests in Poland and Hungary and other Soviet bloc states that they wanted to break away from the Soviet Union. And in the city of Leipzig, which is in eastern Germany, they started having in 1980, like around May, I think, of 89, they started every Monday meeting at St. Nicholas Church and having the Montagsdemonstrationen, which are the Monday demonstrations. The first one or two were kind of bloody because the police and the military went in, they beat some people up, and I don't remember if anybody was killed or not, but they were kind of violent. But after that, the leader of East Germany, Erich Honecker, he was a hardliner. The Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, was much more moderate, and he told Honecker to back down and let them have their protests, which Honecker was kind of opposed to that, but he needed Soviet backing to continue and stay in power. And so the Monday demonstrations went on until in November of 1989, Gorbachev finally decided, we've already got the border with Hungary open and people are leaving through Hungary and going into Austria. Let's just go ahead and let's just open the borders. And so they did. They opened the borders in November of 89, and people were able to actually come and go freely, which is a great difference compared to how it was initially, when people who would try to escape would be killed.
So, the days leading up to the wall falling, what did you see?
We just saw a lot of political activity. We heard about it a lot in the news. And it was something that we didn't really discuss at work. But, again, my good fortune that allowed me to be where I was at, I did get to talk to the family, Horst, specifically, about what was going to happen as it led up to this pending reunification. And, yeah, we spent a lot of time talking about it when I'd go up there and have dinner with them or spend Sunday with them. What was going to happen, how we thought it was going to go and how it was going to progress.
And what did you think was going to happen?
What we thought was going to happen was initially the border, if it reopened, we thought there was going to be just a lot of happiness because it was a long time coming, reuniting the Germanys, reuniting families and friends that had been separated for years, some of them by just a couple of blocks, but couldn't even see each other or call each other because they lived on opposite sides. There would be a lot of happiness about that, but we were also a little more pragmatically thinking about it in that we knew it was going to be a very difficult transition.
And did that actually happen? Were you guys correct? Or?
Yeah, we actually were fairly correct in our assumption because it turned out to be the first year or so was very, everybody was ecstatic. Germany was one people again. But then as time progressed, it turned into a good 30-year process that even today, not everything is completely rectified. And there are some differences and actually some animosity between West Germans and former East Germans.
What was the reason for this animosity?
There were several reasons for the animosity. One is you have to think about they were separated for close to 40 years. And so even though they spoke the same language, they were two completely different cultures. And by cultures, I mean not just their day-to-day life, their political ideology, and their political beliefs. When you grow up in a capitalist society, you believe in you have the freedom to choose, and you can get as rich as you want or stay as poor as you want, but you're basically responsible for yourself. When you grow up in a socialized system, everything is kind of decided for you. Your opportunities are limited, but that's kind of your lot in life. And there's no real, while there is poverty, it's not the same poverty as from a Western viewpoint, because everybody is cared for by the state. Everybody has a minimum wage, everybody has food, everybody has medical care. It's not the best quality, but everybody has it. Those of the inner circle, of course, in those types of societies, they have access to everything that is of better quality, from better food to better benefits to better pay to better medical care. Whereas in the Western side, you work for what you want. And so when you try to even peacefully unify those two different social structures, there are different expectations. On the Western side, they expect the Easterners to suddenly get up to speed and work at a competitive level. And on the Eastern side, they're expecting to have the state continue taking care of them, which was not always going to be the case. And that created some problems. The other part of the problem was on the Western side, when they rebuilt factories after World War II, they were built to Western standards, to include safety standards. In the Eastern side, none of those standards existed. And so, as they were incorporated into the Western capitalist economy, a lot of Eastern factories had to be shut down for safety reasons.